Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Alex Dean. Alex calls himself an amateur historian, sharing weird and wonderful historical tales to over 40,000 Twitter followers, alongside hosting the podcast Hidden History Happy Hour. He is a regular commentator on political events on UK and international news channels, a non-practicing barrister, and has worked directly in politics as a Conservative Party aide. His new book, More Lessons from History, continues the brilliant historical tales from the first volume with 100 stories from across the globe, covering ancient history up until 20th century, all smartly reflected upon with a conclusive lesson for the reader to take away. Today, we want to chat about some of these rollicking tales whilst delving into the more serious lessons that we and our politicians can and should take from history. Hi, Alex. Great to have you back for round two on Bite Back.
Thank you very much.
Books.
And, great to be back. Thank you very much for everything Bite Back has done.
Oh, our pleasure. And for all those who might not have tuned in before to Bite Back Chats Books, could you just give us a brief rundown of how you came onto Lessons from History and the origins of these two books?
Thank you very much. Yes, I started telling stories on Twitter in lockdown, bored as I was and at home with my parents in Suffolk. You weren't allowed out. I started telling stories online. I honestly, Nell, didn't know if I was going to tell 10. And such was the response from other people similarly locked down and encouraging that there's 94 stories in book number one, and there's several stories in the books that aren't on Twitter. And book number two's got 100 stories. They are over 5 million views online. It's extremely flattering. Mm-hmm. I told some Twitter stories having no idea it was going to become a book. Now two books in, and I've got my own podcast about it. So, you know, it's a fascinating outcome of lockdown, but it's also a social media thing, which is I suppose quite a funny thing for a set of books about history, but a very modern thing.
And you mentioned in the last episode that you're predominantly a keen military historian, and there are oodles of military stories in the first and many in the second.
Yeah.
Have you enjoyed exploring other parts of history with, as you say, the social media and this network you've created, and any areas in particular?
Yeah, it's really, thanks for asking. It's really interesting that the things that people get interested in and the things that have a response. One of the areas that has really had strong response and I've kind of picked up is sport. And there's a great number of people who have some interest in history, but are fanatical about sport. So I told the story in the first book about Alfie Langer, who came back to win State of Origin with Queensland in Australia. You know, Queensland, pound for pound, best athletes in the world. If you don't know that, just ask them and I'll tell you. And in book two, I told the story of Clive Nicol, who was the only name on the score sheet in a 2-2 draw in the English league. It's the only game I know of where a man scored four times, two for each side. and that went everywhere. Indeed, I did a little footnote in the book about Dennis Law, who of course played for Manchester City, who scored 6 goals in a game before it was abandoned due to bad conditions. He'd never scored 6 goals before or again, and it was a cancelled game. In the replay, he scored again and they lost. He scored 7 times across 2 games and lost. That sort of thing went everywhere. So people love their sporting stories. But you're right. My first love is military history.
And what stories are you asked about the most? Would it be sport then, or did you say military?
No, funnily enough, the two stories I get asked about the most, the first one is that not that many people, it seems, know that there was another battle in 1066 apart from the Battle of Hastings. I tell in my book the story of the Battle of Stamford Bridge. And if people know it, they know it because there's this legend that there was a Viking holding the bridge, and an Englishman rode up underneath it in a little boat and stabbed him up in the unmentionables. But that wasn't the story that I wanted to tell. The story that I wanted to tell was the story of King Harold's brother, Tostig, who was on the other side, who was fighting, who had, you know, joined forces with the Norwegians and with Harald Sigurdsson, and of the division between those two men. Because if they could have worked out their dispute, it is very likely that the Battle of Stamford Bridge, which the English won, wouldn't have happened. And therefore our forces at Hastings would have been all the stronger. And it's altogether possible that our King Harald, you know, famous arrow in the eye, our King Harald would have defeated William the Conqueror. And so on these individual personal relationships turn amazing things. So I get asked about that a lot because there's a famous exchange I talk about in the book where Tostig and his Viking Norwegian allies are ready for battle, and a little party of Englishmen ride up to talk to them. And, you know, these men wear armor up to the eyes, so you couldn't recognize anyone. And the English party called out to the Norwegian lines, is Earl Tostig with you? So first double negative that I know of in our tongue. Tostig shouts back, it cannot be said that he is not. the English party says, we will have peace with you and you can come back and be an earl and you can have a third of the kingdom. But Tostig says, well, what will you give my ally, the King of Norway? And the answer is, well, you can have 6 feet of good English ground, perhaps a little more because he's so tall. And Tostig says, no deal. You know, I won't betray my friends. And as the English ride back to their battle lines, King Harald Hardrada of Norway asks Tostig, who was the Englishman we were talking with? And Tostig says, that was my brother. And Hardrada berates him and says, you know, why, if he'd come so close, we could have had him and he would not have returned to his own. And Tostig said, I know, but if I'd betrayed his identity, I would be his murderer. One of us will die today. And I would rather that he should be my murderer than I should be his. Okay. Those few lines shouted across the battle lines were the last words the brothers ever spoke to each other. Oh. And I find that a really poignant story. You know, that was my brother. Mm. I get asked about that one a lot, not least because a lot of people, seems, as I say, they don't know that before we fought the Great Battle of Hastings and British history was changed forever, we fought another battle at York and basically ended the Viking invasions into these islands. So that one I get asked about a lot. And the other one I get asked about a lot is a lot shorter, is the story of Urgot of Rye, which is a fungus. And it's a fungus that produces something called lysergic acid, which is a precursor to this
is a great one,
LSD. Now, we understand that really well, right? But it was very poorly consumed in the Middle Ages. And it meant that people were eating bread from a rye contaminated with this fungus. And they were basically dropping massive tabs of LSD day after day, week after week, by the villageful. And now, you might think this helps to explain, you know, the many mass hallucinations. Historians have looked back and tried to say, well, were they were kind of communal deceptions and people went along with things. No, people really were completely out of their trees. And that's why you get these religious visions all the time. People heard voices, they witnessed the heavens open, they saw the face of God. They weren't making things up. They were on massive benders.
That must have been quite hard to research for that story, as in the Middle Ages, to find the primary sources and all that.
It's still known to this day, right? Mm. So we had a shortage of the availability of things to make bread, right? During the recent Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And the percentage that you could allow ergot of rye in bread was negotiated like this year, 2022, to try and make it, to try and give more leeway. So it's actually very well known now. Other couple of things that I think is funny about it. First of all, it doesn't just affect humans, it affects cattle. So cows were having cows on LSD. Cows were having, because they ate the same stuff.
Cow jumped over the moon.
Now you know why the cow's laughing. And secondly, one of the main things that exhibited itself in was so-called dancing mania. Whole villages would just dance until they were exhausted or dropped or died. And if you think about a modern rave, you might think depending on your own experience or not, depending on one's hobbies, you might say there are quite obvious modern day comparisons.
Mm.
But I just imagine how terrifying it must be to have a bad acid trip when your entire village, everyone you know, everyone you've never left your village, everyone you've ever known is dropped a massive dose of LSD daily and without understanding what's going on.
God, that's an extraordinary story. I mean, you tell these stories and they're so fascinating. I feel like I could listen to you talk about them for hours, like story time. Another one I absolutely love is the William Corner murder. I think there's something it could be made into a film. It's got this like slightly psychological thriller drama aspect to it. Could you tell us about that story? And
sure.
Then if you also could cast anyone as William Corner, who would it be in?
great question. So I'm from Bury St Edmunds, and it's where I wrote the first book. And long story short, William Corder, fraudster and a cad and a great deal worse, he got a local girl called Mariah Martin into trouble. And despite the child that she had of him dying in infancy, he met with her at a place called the Red Barn, which is in Polstead in Suffolk, quite near where I grew up. Mm. And he, on the promise of eloping with her all the way to Ipswich, callously he murdered her there. One of the reasons that people with my kind of childhood life and experiences know about the story is that Moyses Hall, the museum in Bury, is very eclectic. So what a museum should be, it's eclectic, it's eccentric, full of random knickknacks and odds and sods. And one thing in the museum is a contemporary account of the Corder murder, his capture and his trial, which is bound in his skin. They stripped his skin off his body and they bound the book in it. And I don't think it's just my imagination that means as children in the early 1980s, we were encouraged to touch it. I'm pretty sure that we were. And there's also a death mask of his. So people, you'll take a cast of somebody after death.
Yeah.
And that's in there too. But I was also, so I was born in West Suffolk Hospital, and so it's now moved sites since Corder's day. But after he died, they took his skeleton and put it in a box in West Suffolk Hospital. And when visitors walked towards the box, they would step on a pressure plate, and that pressure plate would raise the skeleton's arm, and an outsketched skeletal finger would point to the donation box. I mean, it was a very different attitude towards the dead, I suppose. And it was, I think it was supposed to be a brave person who didn't chip in a few coins.
Yeah.
Interestingly, those who had rigged that up suffered, they claimed, such bad luck and ill fortune that they were convinced that the desecration of Corder's body had damned them, and they paid for a decent burial for his bones in the end. But different bits of Corder were sold all over London, were sold all through the UK, and ultimately the last portions of William Corder retained for scientific study by the Royal College of Surgeons was returned to his descendants in 2004. Right. So this is not actually totally ancient history. So the murder in Polstead was in May 1827. And you get the ultimate return of the last bits that the RCS had hung on to only in 2004. It's remarkable.
Mm, and the lesson from that is be very cautious of those suggesting elopement to Ipswich.
Correct. If someone says to you, I'm going to show you a good time, let's bunk off to Ipswich together, beware.
Yeah,
and in answer to your question, who would play William Corder in the movie? I'm going to go against type, but it's a very unfashionable view these days. I can't think of a Tom Cruise movie I haven't enjoyed. I'd love to see him playing a real pantomime villain. I actually thought his Jack Reacher, who's famously supposed to be massive, and Tom Cruise is tiny. I actually thought he pulled that off quite well. So I'm going to say Tom Cruise.
Mm. And I mean, there's so many we could go on for hours about all these stories. I liked the snake oil story, and I studied history at university and have done a lot of social history through that, which was really cool because you got to know the knickknacks and weird things that also cumulatively made the greater story for that period of history. And one of the things I learned, used a lot, was idioms and how clever and amazing these small nuggets of history, like the difference between get fired and get the sack in history.
Oh, tell me that. I don't know that. I don't know the difference.
So get fired comes from when miners carried their own tools from job to job. Like today, stealing was a serious offence, and any miner caught taking valuable materials such as coal, tin or other ore was immediately dismissed. So as to prevent them repeating their crime in another employment, their tools would be confiscated and burnt at the plant, and their tools would literally get fired.
Get fired? And oh, that's interesting.
And then get the sack originates from when tradesmen travel, you know, when people have a stick with a bag on the end, looking for work. And they generally own their own tools and carried them around in a big sack. And when they got to a job, they would hand over their sack to their employer to look after their safe things. And at the end of the job, or if they didn't want them anymore, they would give them the sack.
You would get the sack.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And those cool little stories that we can connect with, and they're much more approachable and easy to understand in history.
Yeah, sure.
Like your snake oil story, I really love, because that was like a weird one on language that was really cool. I mean, could you tell
Clark
us briefly
Stanley.
About that?
Of course, Snake Oil Stanley was a con man, a huckster, 19th century. It was famous in the United States that the Chinese workers had this amazing oil that they brought with them as they were working on the railways, that they came from snakes. And there aren't many Chinese water snakes in the US. So Charles Stanley took to Clark Stanley, excuse me. Entirely blameless firm called Charles Stanley. I just blooped on. Clark Stanley started using, he claimed, rattlesnakes in the Wild West to make an oil. Two hiccups, really. First of all, rattlesnake oil doesn't have the properties that the Chinese water snake has, so it was never going to work to begin with. And secondly, Stanley's snake oil, which became famous and made him very wealthy, was entirely lacking in snake oil. He started selling it in 1893. The Pure Food and Drug Act in the US passed in 1906. Until 1917, no one bothers to look into Stanley's snake oil. So he's had a lifetime, professional lifetime of flogging this stuff. When they finally investigate it, it's made up of mineral oils, beef fat, some red pepper, which I imagine was for colouring, and turpentine. But the amount of actual snake oil in Stanley's snake oil was a rather bold 0%. And having defrauded people up and down the United States all his life, he sucked up his $20 fine without complaint. And we got the expression snake oil salesman, which has been with us forevermore.
It's a cool thing. It's like a nugget of history that it's a lighthearted way to look back at history rather than the intense dates and remembering, and as you traditionally taught in school. And what do you think the role of these short stories are in history today for the many?
So I, one of the great things that I've been told when these books have come out is the number of people who said, variations on, my son, my daughter never liked history at school, but my God, they tore through your book. They really loved these stories. They could learn this way. They enjoyed a story by anecdote. They enjoyed history by anecdote. They enjoyed history as a fun story. And one of the big things about the stories in my books is they are short. They are, you know, 2-3 pages long. It's a, you know, a visit to the toilet will get you through one or two of them. And you don't have to have a long attention span. It doesn't feel like homework. And so what the nicest feedback of all that I've had, there's lots of people who bought them, obviously. And there's lots of people who've read them online and like having the book as well. But the nicest thing is people who said, I have really struggled to get John, Janet interested in history, but I gave them your book, and having pulled a funny face at the start because it looked like a history book or whatever, they just belted through it. And that's the nicest thing. So I think that's the role of these stories, if it has a purpose beyond being a bit of fun.
Yeah, and I think there's also a slightly more serious note in the way that you've used it as lessons from history. And I mean, as Carl Sagan said, you have to know the past to understand the present. And many great lovers of history have gone on to be politicians, successful politicians, like, for example, Winston Churchill. What is your opinion on this then, the significance of the study and knowledge of history in politics?
Well, that's so interesting. Of course, Churchill said that history would be kind to him because he intended to write it. And there is a part of that, right? There is a victor's justice in history. There's a victor's law and the winner's right history. But I also think that It's good to know your history. In the first book, I told the story about Julius Caesar being kidnapped by Cilician pirates and spending months with them before he was ransomed back to his family. And he marshaled them in lines and lectured them. And he was not normal prisoner. And he said to them as they were frolicking on the beach one day, "Gosh, we're having such a good time. It's going to be ever so sad when I have to come back and crucify the lot of you." And oh, how they laughed until he did. Right. And there's a lesson applicable right up to this day about taking people's threats at face value and about listening to what people say, because they may well mean what you're willing to pass or write off. And I think about recent events east of us and our friends in Ukraine and what they've had to undergo of late. And I cannot help but think Vladimir Putin should have been taken at his word about the bellicosity in which he expressed himself. I think that's a lesson for the ages. And there's something in politics about heeding those lessons too. I tell quite a few stories in the books about politics, and there's a different one that I think is interesting. In Congress, they invented a game. They claim in the U.S. Congress, they claim to have invented a game called paddleball, which you see quite frequently now. The bat looks a bit like that thing you used to use.
Yeah,
in swing.
I know what you mean. Yeah,
yeah. It's got the wooden bat with the holes drilled through it for to reduce air resistance, and. The reason I mention it is that there was a congressman who was famous for enjoying playing that game, and he was asked why he enjoyed playing it. And the answer I thought was most interesting was that because he was a congressman, he had an inalienable right to play in the game. And as a child, Benjamin Rosenthal, congressman, had always been left out when kids were picking people. I think that's such an interesting answer. And you wonder how many politicians feel like that and are motivated by that, and not just about sports. You know, some people say politics is show business for ugly people, but yeah, how many people get that drive to excel in politics? How many of them scale the heights because they are seeking to prove to the ghosts of children on long forgotten playgrounds that they've now made it? I think that's really interesting. And politics, a lot of personal history goes into politics as well as the history of nations.
Mm. And I think that's really applicable to a lot of countries around the world, their politics. And we've always been taught to learn from our mistakes of the past.
Right.
And I'm sure in the many countries across the world that there'll be a lot of stories for everyone, especially there are a lot of American and Australian stories I notice in this book. What particular country, animal, object, person would you like to explore next around the world and learn from history there?
It's a fair point. I've lived in Australia, and I spent a lot of time in the US. I work for a US listed company, so it's natural to focus a bit, I suppose, on those countries. It's Belgium features quite regularly across the two books, because of course so many wars fought across it, and an interesting country constituted in its current form really quite recently. There's not enough in the two books about Asia, and I think that'll be a focus if I'm lucky enough.
Okay.
And Biteback's willing to take me, and,
yeah.
and I do a third one. I think there'll be a fair bit more Asian thoughts, and I think whilst I do tell a few stories that are relevant for this, Latin America isn't an area that I've not paid sufficient attention to either yet, and it's of course a place with rich history. So I suppose those are my two geographical answers.
Yeah.
Animal, I mean, because there's a story in this book about a bird, there's a story, a little bird, a songbird, there's a story in this book about a big bird, it's a story about emus.
Oh, that's a great one.
Animals do okay. There's a story about pigs, there's a story about a pig that goes and eats someone's potatoes and nearly causes a war. So animal, in the first book, there's a story about a bear that nearly caused a nuclear war. So animals do pretty well in my books already. And and there's a story in the second one about a dog that extinguishes a bomb by peeing on it. Animals come out of lessons from history and more lessons from history pretty well. don't think there's any, I don't feel I've neglected an animal particularly. But of course, the other answer is that a lot of my stories are driven by what my audience suggests. A significant number of these stories are gifted to me kindly by people who follow me on social media and love history as much as I do and say, go on, tell this one. So maybe they've got some animals up their sleeve. I can't, literal or metaphorical sleeves that I haven't thought of yet.
That's great. And then we have one question that we ask everyone, which is not necessarily related to the book, but I think you might like to answer. If you were a kitchen utensil, what kitchen utensil do you think you would be?
Pepper grinder.
Okay.
Spicing things up a little bit. Often used in small doses. It can be flashy, but it's also got an everyday function.
Flavorsome stories. Yeah, exactly. That's a great answer. Well, thank you so much, Alex. And your book, More Lessons from History, is out now in store and online. Thank you for being on.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. More Lessons from History, Uncovering the Colourful Characters of the Past, is available to buy now online and in store. Head to the Bite Back website to use your exclusive 20% off code, MLFH20. If you enjoyed this discussion, you might also be interested in our online articles with exclusive pieces from our authors, such as Tom Harper on the failures of the Metropolitan Police and Mark Easton on island identity. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at BiteBackPub.